Thank you very much. I'm Mel Barger, an alcoholic. And really, I'm terribly nervous tonight. I've been getting a great buildup out here, and I think I've been oversold a little bit here. But this is really a nice group here tonight. I've been to three AA meetings since we got here Thursday, and this is just great. This is the day I would have my regular meeting back in Toledo at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I belong to the Rab Road group out there. It's about 10 miles west of town, out in the country. And I told him this morning at the meeting, when I'm driving out there for our 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon meeting, there's no place in the world I'd rather be than right there. That's just something I feel. Well, I guess we start out by saying, given our sobriety date, my sobriety date is April 15th, 1950, and I tell people that I have 55 years of alcohol sobriety and 45 years of cigarette sobriety and 10 minutes of emotional sobriety. I got to be 80 years old somehow. I'm 80 years old. I also say I'm so old that I can remember when a gay bachelor was a guy who chased women. I want to thank you for this podium. I like a podium that covers me up in case I forget to zip up. At my age, I sometimes forget to zip down. I asked somebody, "What do you do about that?" And they said, "Well, it depends." you've met my wife, Lori, there, and we've been married 45 years. And I also tell people she's probably the only woman in the country that could put up with me for 45 years, although many of them would like me for one night. I would like to tell my personal story, and then just a few things about AA history that I learned. Tad said, I did know Bill Wilson. I didn't have a long friendship with him like that little blurb implied. I heard him speak for the first time in 51, and I think the last time I talked with Bill briefly was in 64. But over the years, I met him a few times in the New York office and also heard him speak several times. And I took some pictures of him in 1958 at Dr. Bob's gravesite in Akron. And those pictures, one picture has been used in several books now. And I knew at the time that I took it that that's what was going to happen to it. You know, certain things you feel in the program, they just work out that way. But I had covered my story I write limericks once in a while. And I got a little bit of Irish background. I have two Irish great-grandmothers. That may be where I got my alcoholism, but I don't have any resentment because that's where I also got my good looks. Anyway, this is my story in 12 limericks, 12 verses. A fearful young man from Nebraska drank amounts that would surely aghast you. He'd take any old slop and drink till he'd drop and finally fell on his aska. But that man from Nebraska got well. That's the story he now wants to tell. He had loads of self-pity, and life was quite shitty. But AA took him out of that hell. He went to a place on a hill. It was run for the mentally ill. Some thought he was crazy and maybe just lazy, or a chap just in search of a thrill. He admitted his problem was boozing. It had gone past the point of mere choosing. He was hooked on the stuff and was now on his duff, and booze was the cause of his losing. He learned that the problem in drinking was linked to the way he was thinking. He needed to hear how resentments and fear had made his life useless and stinking. Though his emotions were raw and still bleeding, he took time to start some good reading. He started to look at AA's big book and found answers he had always been needing. He found that a God of his choosing could help him give up all that boozing. The book made it plain that he could abstain, though life might be tough and confusing. That man from Nebraska, still fearful, saw days that were far less than cheerful. But when he was bleeding, he went to a meeting, and friends helpfully gave him an earful. He learned to share secrets with others, with folks who were sisters and brothers. It gave them all gain, though sometimes with pain, and improved them as fathers and mothers. This fearful young man soon got better and escaped from John Barleycorn's fetter. He lives day by day and takes time to pray and follows the steps to the letter. He knows that his status in life and the love of his children and wife is a gift from AA that came day by day and brought him from misery and strife. He lives now in Ohio's Glass City, a town that some folks might pity. Though some think it dull, his life is quite full, and AA has made things quite pretty. I wanted to give my little things to... Thank you. Okay. Well, I'll still tell what happened in the story. I was born in Norfolk, Nebraska in 1925 and grew up there during the Depression. And I guess I grew up with a lot of resentments and self-pity and fear, all of the things that go hand in hand with alcoholism. And I had today would be called a dysfunctional family. My parents separated in the mid-30s. And there was a lot of resentment and self-pity about that. I had an older sister who did very well and a younger brother who also did well. But I was in the middle, and I was really a great underachiever. And it seemed that there was a barrier between me and other people. I didn't get along well with other kids. That was one thing. It was kind of a benefit that I didn't get along with people, because as I became more dysfunctional, if any other kids had been planning on robbing a filling station or doing something bad like that, they wouldn't have invited me along. Even the guys who were in trouble didn't like me very well. So that's how I grew up. But when I was about 13 or 14, I got in some of my dad's wine. And boy, I found something. I didn't become a drunk overnight or anything like that, but right there, I found something that registered that there was something that would give me a different feeling about myself and the world and everything else. And I think my alcoholism started somewhere there. But I didn't, of course, become a drunk overnight or anything like that, but I went out fishing with an uncle and drank all of his beer. And by 1941, I had dropped out of high school, and my dad and my stepmother were living out in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, which is just north here, north and east a little ways. I dropped out of school there, and I just wasn't performing well at anything. And I finally got kicked out of... You know, my parents had custody fights about me. Each one wanted the other to take me. I wound up going down to Denver about early, maybe January or February of 1942. I was 16 years old. I dropped out of school. I had about a year's credit in high school. I went to work in the Fitzsimmons General Hospital in Denver. And I discovered I could drink in their PX. They had beer in their PX, and even though I was only 16 years old, I could go in there and drink with the soldiers and other people who worked there. And I worked at a few other places in Denver, and then around May or June, I went out to California. And I remember catching a ride with a guy out of Salt Lake City, he had a bottle. And he gave me two or three slugs out of his bottle, and then when I wanted another, he said, "Kid, you're one of those people who can't drink." Now there I was, 16 years old, and I didn't know it, but this guy, who was probably a drunk himself, had diagnosed me as an alcoholic. Well, I wound up spending a year in Vallejo, California. I worked for a while at the Mare Island Navy Yard and other places around there. I had a habit of getting fired from jobs for not getting along well with people and also for not doing my work. But there in Vallejo, I discovered, that's right near the Napa Valley, I discovered wine. Now, you know, there were goofy people around, and somebody would say, he's a wino. Well, I didn't want to be a wino, but you know, you could get a bottle of wine there for 25, 30 cents. They had little neighborhood stores. And you could take a jar in and fill it up with wine out of a barrel in the back for 15 or 20 cents. So it was easy to become a wino. But I discovered after I got an AA that a wino is no different than a beer-o or a whiskey-o. We're drinking it for the alcohol that's in it. And so finally around March of 43, I left Vallejo, went back to Nebraska where my mother lived, and was there a couple months, and I was starting to drink, get drunk now and then, and find ways to find booze and so on. And I got drunk one night and just really got beaten up badly. Now that was something that would happen to me every now and then. I was always hitting people on the fist with my nose after, when I'd been up there in Scott's Bluff after I dropped out of school on New Year's Eve in 1941, a truck driver and his girlfriend had come in with a bottle, and I'd started drinking with him, and about midnight he had knocked me into a snowdrift. So these are things that happened to me. Well, then in May of 1943, I joined the Navy, and I spent 3.5 years in the Navy, and 2 years of it out in the Western Pacific. This was during World War II. Actually, I don't know if there was any connection, but the war started to turn in our favor the very month I enlisted. And I wound up on an amphibious ship. They called them LSTs. They were ships that would run right up on the beach. They had bow doors, and they would disgorge tanks and weapons and everything else, trucks. And so I wound up getting 5 battle stars out in the Pacific. But in fact, I was in Okinawa when the atomic bomb was dropped on this. But there was one incident that happened in the Navy. Now, I did quite a bit of drinking, but one incident stood out. We were anchored in the Philippines, late March of 1945. And we were all loaded up with troops and supplies and everything else. We knew we were leaving the next day. Well, they let a third of the ship's company go ashore. This was a little island in the Philippines. They had a little recreation area. And they gave you 3 cans of beer. And they gave it to you. They carried it on the ship. You couldn't drink it on the ship, but they gave it to you when you went ashore. So I went ashore, and as I got off the boat, the Liberty boat on the dock, a Filipino came up, and he had his shirt stuffed with beer bottles. And he said this was potato whiskey, and it was $5 a bottle, 10 pesos, I think. Well, I turned it down because we'd been warned about this bad stuff that people were selling. And so I had my 3 cans of beer. Another guy gave me his, and I bought 3 more. And then suddenly there was nothing more to drink on that beach. So I look up the potato whiskey man, and I bought his bottle, and I remember buying 1 more. And then the next thing I knew, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, 0400 Navy time, and I was in the boat. It had been hoisted on the davits. They had carried me back to the boat and then just hoisted me up. And there I was at 4 o'clock in the morning, really sick, terribly sick. And we left the next day for Okinawa. We were in on the invasion of Okinawa, which was April 1st, 1945, Easter Sunday. I think I was still sick when I got there. And I didn't get anything out of that experience until after I got into AA and realized that I'd had the sanity to turn down something that might be harmful when I hadn't had anything to drink. But then with 9 cans of beer, I got anything. And that's why you find out that people die of drinking wood alcohol and all of that. You know, I've been wondering about all this ethanol that they're putting in gas tanks. You know, that is probably drinkable. And yeah, because that's what alcohol is, you know. What'll happen when alcoholics discover that? When you can buy it for $2 a gallon. Well, I got out of the Navy in late 1946 and went home to Nebraska. And, you know, I stayed drunk as long as my money lasted. And I didn't even realize that I was on a continuous drunk. And then by 1947, I got started getting shut off in bars now and then. In fact, I could get shut off in a bar after two drinks sometimes. Not always, but there was something about me. I think these bartenders have radar, and they know who's going to be troublesome. And I could almost tell when a bartender was going to shut me off. Now, there I was, only 21 years old and already so bad that I was getting shut off in bars, and my behavior was pretty bad, too. And I was wearing out my welcome, and it had never been warm anyhow, and I was wearing it out more and more. Well, then I went out to Idaho, where my dad lived, out near Boise, Idaho, and wore out my welcome there, and finally wound up early in 1948, destitute in a little town on the Oregon-Idaho border. And I was ashamed to go back to my dad's house. So I went out and I worked on a railroad Gandhi gang. And you know, those are guys that worked up and down the railroad, lived in railroad cars, all alcoholics, every one of them. They couldn't run that railroad without those guys. And worked on the tracks, you know, they did the tamping and the ballasting and all of that. And it's kind of scared me that when I looked at what those guys, what their lives were like and so on, and they'd sit around in the railroad car at night and talk about, oh, you don't want to get picked up in Pocatello, or watch out for those cops in Salt Lake City, you know, this kind of thing. Well, I wasn't going to be like them. Well, I get paid after about a month, and I go into this little town of Weezer, Idaho. And by gosh, I wake up the next morning in jail, and I don't even remember where they found me. I passed out on the sidewalk at 1:30 in the morning. And so I went back and stayed with my dad for a while, and then I got drunk over in Boise and took a cab 30 miles without a cent to pay the cab driver. Well, you know, that doesn't go over. And I wound up getting a jail sentence out of that. And shortly after that, I left, and I hitchhiked all the way down to Southern California, where my sister lived. You know, and looking back at how I survived those years, well, even like when I was 16 years old in Denver, how did I get by? I was so sick and troubled and everything else. There must be a higher power looking out for us, because I certainly wasn't looking out for myself those years. Well, then I was in Ventura, California, and I got a job working in the oil fields, and that's just terrible work. Nobody should even have to do that. I'm incapable of that kind of physical work, especially with a hangover, but somehow I made it through that summer. And that fall, I got in touch with AA. That was in October of 1948, maybe the 5th or 7th of October. And a guy came out to where I was rooming and took me to a meeting in a little town, Santa Paula, California. And I kind of really fell in love with AA from that point on. But, you know, I only stayed sober 5 months, because I was only 23, and people would come up and say, "Boy, kid, if you get the program at your age, it'll really be terrific." But their tone of voice was, "You poor devil, you won't." You know, people under 30 were just not making the program very well then. That 30 was considered young. And but you know, one funny thing that did happen was the second and third members I met were out from Akron, Ohio. And one of them was one of the first 2,000 members of AA, and one of them was one of the first 200 members of AA. So right at the start, I kind of became an AA historian without realizing it. I didn't realize that someday there'd be something called television and the internet and everything else, and there'd be the AA history lovers and all of that. That was back in 1948, didn't even think about those things. Well, then for 13 months, I had a lot of road testing. And I won't go into the details, but I spent 7 months in the Army. And the Army is not the place for me. I might have gotten along well in the Navy if I hadn't had the drinking problem, but I don't think I could get along well in the Army under any circumstances. In the Navy, if you got back to the ship, you could be dead drunk. As long as you got back to the ship, you were okay. But in the Army, if you come back to the post drunk, may they arrest you. See, that's how intolerant they are. So I got kicked out of the army in New Brunswick, New Jersey, with an undesirable discharge. And the next morning, at 3 o'clock in the next morning, I woke up on a lawn on the edge of town, and I'd been rolled. And my money was gone, my railroad ticket, my belt, and my tie, and even my undesirable discharge. That was gone. Somebody in New Brunswick has an undesirable discharge. He didn't earn. Well, you know, it sounds awfully funny when you tell about it today, but gosh, that's an awful—it's an awful shape to be in, and you know, in a strange town, and then with nothing, in that. But somehow, I got back to Nebraska, and I made it through that winter, was living with my dad or my mother and stepdad. And that next spring, I made it to jail once that winter. I stayed sober a few months at one time. But I didn't go back to AA. And finally that spring, somebody took me out to the state hospital, which was on a hill overlooking my hometown. And I spent 7 weeks in that state hospital, but my sobriety date started with the day that I went out to that state hospital, and I haven't had a drink since. And I've stayed very close to AA ever since. I was 24 years old, getting to be an old man by that time. And AA has been my life since then. And I couldn't have functioned at all without AA. I'm confident of that. I had to stay sober at all costs. I learned that, and I went back to AA. And I thought that the people in the AA group had probably been talking about me there in my hometown. But a guy came out to the state hospital to go to the meeting, and he saw me there, and he says, "I didn't know you were back in town." And you think everybody's always talking about you. And then a few months later, I moved out to Michigan, where I had an aunt and uncle living and worked for them for a while, and lived in Michigan until 1972, and then we moved to Ohio. Around 1960, my wife and I were married. By the way, her folks didn't like it when they learned I was in AA. I'd been sober 10 years by that time, and they didn't like it that when they found out I was in AA. That there was something wrong with that. But her sister was married to a guy that made me look pretty good over time. And, you know, I really shouldn't say that. The poor guy's dead. But and if my sister-in-law were here and heard me say that, she'd be hurt. But so please keep that all to yourselves. Well, anyway, that's how I got sober. And it's been a very good life. We find out that just because you put the plug in the jug, why everything, that's when we start solving problems finally. We were running away from problems when we're drinking, but then you start having to face life when you get sober, and that's what I had to learn. I had to learn how to grow up, and AA helped me do that. I can just look back right from the time I finally quit drinking altogether, why things started to improve. A little bit here and a little bit there, but they did. And I think that anybody can have that same experience in AA. Well, I was going to tell a little bit about AA history. I've only talked for 15 minutes, and I've told my whole story. Pardon? Now that's really something. I guess I've gone to about 13,000 or 14,000 meetings somewhere, something like that. I go to a lot of meetings. I go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. In fact, they get tired of seeing me. I have this regular group, the Rab Road Group, which is out west of Toledo, as I said, and that meets at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. But there's a noon meeting downtown that I go to quite a bit. And I tell them... I told him this week that I was coming out to save AA in Fort Collins. And that's become a kind of a joke, you know, when I go somewhere to talk. Where are you going to save AA this week or something like that? And then I always get treated well on these trips. And I went back one day and told my group, I says, how come I get treated so well? And I come back here and you folks crap on me all the time. And they said, well, we know you, Mel. One of the people I had way up on a pedestal was Bill W. And in 1951, Bill came out to Detroit. I was living in Pontiac, Michigan by that time. And I was living with these relatives. And I had an old car that it was a real cold night. I probably couldn't have made it down to Detroit on those icy roads in this terrible old car that I had. But some guys took me down there to hear Bill W. give a talk. And Bill was barnstorming the North America, I guess, all the big cities in the United States and Canada, promoting what he called the third legacy. Anybody know what the third legacy was? That was service. The three things we have in AA is unity, recovery, and service. And Bill was promoting what became the General Service Conference. And I just went down to Detroit with these guys to hear him talk. And you know, there's a book called Pass It On, that's the biography of Bill. And page 348 is my little account of that night of going down to hear Bill. But I never got to meet him that night. He gave a two-hour talk. It was interrupted by a cigarette break. About 1,500 people came over there to hear him. But he was talking about the necessity of having a general service conference so that AA could be controlled by the grassroots, so that the people in the fellowship could control the central office and have a say in how things were run. Well, I couldn't have cared less about that. I just wanted to hear Bill give a talk. But since then, have I got to know more about AA and how things work. I think that showed tremendous vision on his part, that if we didn't have the General Service Conference, AA probably would have split apart, because there's a lot of people around that want to run things their own way. So some of the people that were against Bill were in Akron, Ohio, and Cleveland, those places, you know, people that should have been very grateful to Bill for coming out there and carrying the message and all that. But a lot of them were jealous of Bill. I heard people say bad things about Bill. But having the General Service Conference and this feedback and everything, I think it's kind of kept a lid on things over the years. Bill had an ability to look ahead and see what the problems were down the road. I think, in some ways, that he was a genius at the things he could see. For example, AA came under attack in 1963. Up until 1963, everybody said good things about AA. Every newspaper article, there was one real smutty magazine that had an article called AA, No Booze But Plenty of Babes, or something like that. But that was the only bad article that ever came out up until 1963. But in 1963, Harper's Magazine ran a cover story, AA, Cult or Cure, Alcoholics Anonymous, Cult or Cure, and it was written by a guy with a PhD from Columbia, no less. And you know, when anybody runs a magazine article with a title like that, Cult or Cure, you know they're going to come out negative. And it really was a very negative article. And boy, AA is all over the country, mad as hell. Nobody in AA ever read Harper's until that day, that month. And my gosh, letters came in to Harper's from all over the country. In fact, I wrote one, and I'm glad they never published it. And but Bill, they went to Bill and asked him what we should do about that. And Bill said, well, let's look at what, and he had a little publication that he had prepared called 12 Concepts of World Service. And I remember talking to Bill in New York when he was working on that publication. It's available, I think, in all our central offices. And he goes into 12 Concepts of World Services, and what do you know? It says, suppose AA should come under attack. Yeah, that was written a couple of years before we came under attack. And so what should we do? Well, the answer, he prepared an article for the Grapevine titled, Our Critics Can Be Our Benefactors. And the point of it was that if what these people are saying is true, well, then we should thank them for it and try to correct what is wrong. See? It's like if somebody tells you you got bad breath, well, you know, they're doing you a favor. And he didn't say that. I added that. But then suppose they're terribly wrong, they're unfair and everything else. Well, if you oppose them, he said, unreasonable people are stimulated all the more by opposition. Of course, any married man knows that. And, I should have said that. But, you know, wasn't that so good? And the point of it was that the best defense was no defense at all. And AA never responded to this guy. See, that would have been entering into controversy. Even when somebody attacks AA, that's kind of an outside controversy. So, never responded. And, of course, the guy who wrote the article, I think he was furious about that, because I believe he wanted to become the Ralph Nader of AA, to, you know, have a cottage industry out of writing bad things about AA. He wrote a couple more articles, and then the thing kind of died down. And I tried to look him up some years ago, and I found out he had passed away. So down in Arizona somewhere, and I never could find out what he passed away from or anything else. But anyway, that was how Bill handled that when we came under attack. And you can read about that. You can read that article in a book called The Language of the Heart. That was published by The Grapevine. And it's all of Bill's articles in The Grapevine. And it's just a great publication. If you want to know what Bill thought about what AA should do or about any situation that arises, it's in that book. And it's just great. Well, I always thought that someday I might like to write Bill's biography. Now, that was in the back of my mind. It's funny how you get these ideas. And then in 1975, a biography came out about Bill. And it was about the same time they had the international conference in Denver. And they sold it for a while from the AA World Services, but it had been privately published, so they decided that they wanted their own, that AA should have its own biography. And a fellow wrote the biography of Dr. Bob, which is called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I met that fellow once. His name was Niles. He did a great job on it. They did Dr. Bob's biography first, because they realized that it would have to be based on interviews from people around Akron and so on, and these people were getting pretty old, long in the tooth, so that Niles went out there and, isn't that something to get long in the tooth? And he went out there and interviewed all these old-timers who had known Dr. Bob, and that's what the book is made up of, a lot of these interviews, and it's very good. And I think that was published in 1980, and somebody asked me if I'd had anything to do with that book. I have two photographs in it, the photograph of King's School and the one of St. Thomas Hospital. But then Niles started on Bill's biography, and he got cancer and passed away after he'd just done a little bit of work. So I happened to know the general manager of GSO, so I went in there and threw my hat in the ring, and they gave me the assignment of working on Bill's biography. So I worked on it for 2 years. In 1980 and 81, and in that time, I spent a few days at Stepping Stones. Lois, Bill's wife, she invited me up there, stayed there a couple times. I interviewed Nell Wing, the one that was mentioned. There's a marvelous person, and got in the AA archives, read a lot of Bill's letters and everything. Worked on that for 2 years, and did two manuscripts. And then, by gosh, they hired some more writers to work on it. You know, it's pretty hard to satisfy those people. And they finally came out in 1984 under the title Pass It On. I had wanted to call it Bill W. and His Friends because I thought that went along with Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I could see both books in a slipcase, you know. But the last line of one of my manuscripts, one of the two manuscripts I submitted, was Pass It On. And that's what Bill would tell people when they would come in and express gratitude for everything he had done. Well, he'd tell them, pass it on to somebody else. That's the way you show gratitude in AA. You don't thank Bill or thank any of the old-timers or anything like that. Pass it on to somebody else. Bill always talked about the million who still don't know. He would always write about that, the people who are still in their caves and drinking, that we had an obligation, a duty to keep this thing going for them. And Bill worked real hard to see that that was done, that the AA didn't get loused up. There were a lot of people who had loused it up. And Bill always said, I think to his friends, I never heard him say this, that his personal life wasn't all that great in some ways, but he felt that every decision he had made for AA was right, that he was more like a parent, you know, looking after a child. You know, Bill and Lois never had any children, but I think we are their children in some ways. But he was very protective of AA. He wanted AA to keep functioning the way it did. He had our best interests in mind. But anyway, I worked on this, and when I got to New York, and I was still working for Libby Owens Ford as in public relations by that time. I had worked for a company called AeroQuip in Jackson, Michigan for 19 years. I became editor of their company magazine. And Libby Owens Ford acquired AeroQuip just to get me on their payroll. And I was transferred down to Toledo. That's how I got in Toledo. Somebody told me to be honest tonight. I better be careful. But anyway, Lois invited me out to their home, Stepping Stones, which is in Westchester County near Bedford Hills, New York. It's a little home. It's in a nice wooded section up there. And Bill and Lois had lived in that place since 1941. They hadn't had any money and everything, but some real estate woman got the idea that they deserved having a home. They were living in a couple of rooms in a clubhouse down in New York. And Bill said, well, we don't even have enough money for a down payment. Well, she got them out there and figured out how they could get the house without a down payment. And that's where they lived the rest of their life. I feel that they were supposed to have that house. It was just a wonderful place for them. And Lois lived there the rest of her life until she was 97. She passed away at 97. But she invited me up there. And so I got there, and there was a woman staying there with her named Edna. And this woman couldn't have weighed more than 80 or 90 pounds. She looked awful. And she fluttered around and wanted to help with the dishes and everything. And she sat there and listened patiently while I interviewed Lois and talked with her. And I thought at first that she was probably an Al-Anon woman. And I didn't know much about her. But the whole weekend she was just very, always wanting to try to do something. Well, on Monday, a man came to take her away. And it turned out that Edna had worked for Lois as a housekeeper some years earlier. And then she had been working for another family as a live-in housekeeper or something. And she got sick. And she went to the hospital and she was terminal. You know, that's why she looked so bad when I saw her. But she couldn't stay in the hospital any longer for some reason. And the hospice couldn't take her for another 2 or 3 weeks. And there the poor woman was desperate. She was penniless, had no place to go. And she called up Lois and told her what her situation was. And Lois says, come out and stay with me. And she was staying there with Lois for 3 weeks. And then on Monday morning, a man came in an old car and took her away. And a couple of months later, Lois told me that Edna had died. Now, this woman had been living with a family, working for them. And then when she got sick, she wanted to come back and stay with this family until she could go to the hospice. But, of course, she was no good to him anymore. She couldn't, you know, do the work for her anymore. But Lois, you know, that's the type of person she was. That's probably why she played the role that she did. You know, we owe a lot to people like Lois. And then there was also Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife. And she did things that, you know, we probably don't give her credit for. Well, you know, I've only talked a half an hour. And that means I have an hour and a half to go, right? that was a great experience. And I learned a lot about AA, just going into the archives and talking to some of these old-timers. Some of them didn't like Bill Wilson. And with real credit, I spent a whole day with one guy. He had founded AA in a big city and everything. Couldn't get him to say one good word about Bill, you know. Not one good word. And So you found that. And it was just amazing that our fellowship keeps going the way it is. And of course, when I told the guy, I thought he had a resentment. The way people express resentments in AA, if you tell somebody he's got a resentment, they'll say, "No, I don't have a resentment. I just feel sorry for the poor bastard." It's that kind of thing. I learned some things about AA and Akron. The manuscripts I submitted had a lot to do about the early background in Akron before Bill Wilson got involved out there. And that got chopped out of Pass It On. There wasn't too much of it. And a lot of the stuff that got chopped out of Pass It On, I put in my own books, New Wine, and My Search for Bill W. and Ebby. Those are books that I wrote for Hazelden. They're not conference approved, but by God, I approve of them. and they would all be bestsellers, except that millions of people have chosen not to buy them. But actually, they're doing fairly well, though. But what I learned was that, AA did come out of a fellowship called the Oxford Group. And there's a lot of history about this group. There's very little of it mentioned in AA, but there's been a number of books written about the Oxford Group. And that was founded in 1908 by a guy who had a terrible resentment and got over it. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he had as much resentment as any alcoholic ever had. And he got over it through a spiritual experience. And it's very interesting that we were helped, or we were grew out of an organization that was founded by a guy who overcame a resentment. Well, it flourished, and in the 1920s, it acquired the name the Oxford Group. Got a lot of publicity in those years. You can go back in the old reader's guides and find a lot of articles about the Oxford Group. And a few alcoholics were getting sober in that fellowship. Nothing like what happened in AA, but they were finding out that by following the principles that the Oxford Group had, some alcoholics were recovering. And some of their principles were making restitution, praying for guidance every day, admitting your faults to other, everything we have in the 12 steps, but just not in that form. So around 1934, Bill W. got in the Oxford Group, and that's all in his story about how a fellow named Ebby, didn't give Ebby's name, but that was his old school friend, called on him, and then Bill immediately, Bill had been trying to do everything to try to quit drinking, and nothing had worked, and then he had this big spiritual experience, and that's all in his story. But out in Akron, there was an Oxford Group member who went to work for Harvey Firestone in 1928, a young fellow with a lot of ability. And Harvey Firestone's second oldest son had a terrible drinking problem. And this young Oxford Group member started working with him, trying to help him. And this is in my book, New Wine. And they would go on business trips together. This fellow's name was Bud Firestone. And they would even pray on their knees in the hotel rooms. And Bud would even start crying, this young Firestone fellow, because he couldn't quit drinking. Well, then they went on a trip out to Denver, for crying out loud. And on the way back, Sam Shoemaker, that's the guy in New York who helped Bill Wilson a lot, went into a compartment in the train with Bud and started talking to him. And something happened, and this man told me that when he came out of the compartment, he looked different, just right there. And he got sober, and that was the talk of Akron. You see, the Firestones, they were the people that everybody in Akron looked up to. They were held in awe at that time. And the fact that Bud Firestone had gotten sober became the talk of the town. Now, that was back in 1932. So Harvey Firestone, out of gratitude, sponsored a big Oxford Group rally in Akron. And that's when Dr. Bob and some of the people who were involved with the early A's, that's when they got in the Oxford Group and started following these principles. Well, now that's all part of AA history. See, that had something to do with our getting sober along the way. Dr. Bob, in his personal story, he tells about falling in with a group of people that impressed him because they seemed ill at ease and could talk without self-consciousness or anything like that. And he was uptight all the time. And he went to their meetings for 2.5 years, but got tight every night nonetheless. That's in his personal story in the big book. Well, that was the Oxford group. And they were meeting there in Holmes in Akron. And one of the women who was quite prominent in the Oxford group was a woman named Henrietta Seiberling. Now, this is the woman that Bill Wilson would talk to, who would introduce him to Dr. Bob. And she was the daughter-in-law of Frank Seiberling, who had founded the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. And she lived in the gatehouse of the big mansion called Stan Hewitt. It was a big 55-room mansion there in Akron. And the Seiberlings had built that in 1917. It's a Tudor mansion, one of the best mansions, finest mansions in the whole country. And she was living out in the gatehouse because she was separated from her husband. And her husband was something of a playboy. And he stayed up there in the big house with his parents, and she moved with her three children out to this gatehouse. And that's where Bill and Bob would meet. Well, I never met Henrietta, but I talked with her by phone a number of times. And she kind of told me all the story about what had happened there. And anyway, they knew that Dr. Bob had a drinking problem, but he never mentioned it. He went to these meetings, sat there, and half drunk most of the time, but he never talked about his drinking problem, and all the others, they talked about their problems. So Henrietta got the idea that they ought to flesh Dr. Bob out and get him to admit his faults, his real problem. So she organized a special meeting, and they started talking about their different faults. Well, you know, with most of these Oxford groupers, their faults were little things compared to what alcoholics are up against many times. But they were pretty honest. They all shared their faults. And it got around to Dr. Bob. And he said, you folks have been honest with me, and I'll be honest with you. Now, this might cost me my profession, but I'm a secret drinker. Well, it was only a secret to himself. Everybody else knew. And now, you know, a funny thing about this, though, When I learned this from Henrietta and from a talk she gave out there, that was 3 weeks before Bill called Henrietta looking for an alcoholic. 3 weeks. Now, you see, if he hadn't made that admission, she never would have been able to call Ann and say, I have a man from New York, see, because he was in denial, what we call denial. But anyway, then Bill, in the meantime, got sober in New York. Now, he was only in the Oxford group 5 or 6 months when he met Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob had had more exposure to those things than Bill had. So Bill goes out to Akron. He gets this business deal out there. He's in a proxy fight for a little machine tool company. And that would have put him on his feet if he could have won that proxy fight. He was a stockbroker and pretty good. Bill really was good at what he did. But he went out there and tried to solicit these proxies and everything, and when the stockholders voted, why, he lost. He just didn't have enough proxies. And there he was on a Saturday morning, and he was at the Mayflower Hotel, and he only had about $10. He had gone out there on a shoestring anyhow, and he had the whole weekend to face, and he didn't know what to do, and that's when he realized that he was on thin ice because he had thought about going in the bar and just sitting there and having a soft drink to strike up a conversation. And he realized that was entirely wrong thing to do. He had learned enough about his condition. He just knew that if he went in that bar, he wouldn't come out sober. And so that's when he got the idea of calling this minister, a Dr. Walter Tunks, who happened to be in the Oxford group. And that guy gave him 10 names, and none of them could help Bill, but he did give one guy did tell him about Henrietta Seiberling. And Bill was reluctant to call her because he knew who she was. He knew that he thought she was the wife of Frank Seiberling, who had founded Goodyear. Actually, she was Frank's daughter-in-law. But finally something told him he should, and he called her, and she invited him right out to talk to her, and she called Ann Smith. Bill had introduced himself to Henrietta this way: "I'm a member of the Oxford group, and I'm a rum hound from New York." That's how he described himself. And so Bob had come home. It was the day before Mother's Day, and he had brought a potted plant for Ann, his wife, but he was potted too. And so he was upstairs sleeping it off. And so Henrietta set it up for Bill to come there for dinner the next day, late in the afternoon at the gatehouse. This is a little Tudor-style gatehouse. Now today it has a plaque on it, a historical plaque, saying that this is where the founders of AA met. I was there, we were there last May, the 70th anniversary of their meeting, by the way. And I just had to be in Akron for that day. But anyway, Dr. Bob showed up the next day with Ann, terribly sick. And he was only going to talk to Bill for 15 minutes. And he couldn't eat any dinner. Henrietta had a nice dinner for him, but he couldn't eat anything. But they went in and talked. And they talked for 5 hours. And Dr. Bob said later that this was the first human being he'd ever talked to who knew what he was talking about with regard to alcoholism from personal experience. Now that was something. Here Bob, he was a doctor, an MD, and a graduate of a fine medical school and everything else. But Bill was the guy that really gave him the truth. Well, Bill was broke. His partners sent him a little bit of money to keep. They thought there had been some fraud in the stockholders' election and everything. So they kept sending him a little bit of money to keep him going. But in the meantime, Henrietta wanted to keep Bill there in Akron to talk to Bob. So she got a wealthy neighbor to put him up in the Portage Country Club. Nice country club there in Akron. And there's Bill. Here he is in Akron, broke, and he's staying in this nice country club. Talk about things being taken care of. Well, then after a couple weeks, Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, invited him to come live with them. And they, you know, Smitty, I got to know Dr. Bob's son quite well. He passed on a year or two ago. But he said that when they had guests, why, he and Susan, his sister, had to go up and sleep in the attic. But Bill came there and stayed with them. Well, then Dr. Bob had to go to a medical convention. Now, it was very important that he go to this convention. He'd been going there for 20 years and getting drunk and not learning a damn thing. But still, it was very important. And so he got on the train and started drinking immediately and came back home drunk. Now, Smitty told me, now this is something that I hadn't known. Smitty told me that when Bill learned that Dr. Bob was drunk and back in town drunk, he packed his bags and was going back to New York. He figured he just had another failure. He'd been working with drunks down in New York, not helping a darn one of them. And now he had another one. But Ann, Dr. Bob's wife, talked him into staying. Let's give it one more chance, one more try. And so they got Bob in bed, and he was supposed to perform surgery in 3 days. Now, he had become a specialist. He had been a general surgeon before, but in 1929, he had gone up to Mayo Clinic and studied proctology. And he had become a proctologist. In case you don't know, that's a guy who works on diseases of the rectum, a part of the body that gets very little sunlight. And so he was supposed to perform. But see, the good thing about that was they probably needed somebody like that, a specialist of this kind. But the bad thing was that when he started depending on other doctors for referrals, his drinking started working against him. The other doctors knew he had this problem, and they weren't giving him the referrals. So his practice had pretty much dried up. And so that's why this surgery was kind of important, because if he didn't do it, he would be just letting another doctor down, is what it amounted to. Well, so Bill took him. Bill said that they woke up on the morning. They were in adjoining beds. And Bob says, "I'm going to go through with it." And Bill said, "The surgery?" And Bob says, "No. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get sober and stay that way." So Bill drove him to the hospital and gave him a bottle of beer to steady his nerves. And Bob went in and did the surgery. And then he went around Akron and started talking to all the people he'd been on the outs with, people he had tried to conceal his problems from, told him honestly what had happened, what he was trying to do, and was gone all day. And Bill and Ann thought that maybe he might be off drunk again. But instead, he came home just the happiest man in the world, and he never had another drink. That was the ninth step, really. We didn't have the steps in that form then, but he was working the ninth step, and it worked for him, and he really became, just a tremendous job that he did out there in Akron. He had 80 members in Akron when Bill didn't have 20 in New York, but he just did a great job. And then Bill said the patient lived, talking about the, yeah. And he was, Bill always dramatized things. He said, the patient lived. Well, who in the hell ever died from a hemorrhoid operation, you know? Yeah. So those are the kind of things you learn as you keep digging in, you know, that there were all these little things, just like Ann Smith talking Bill into staying there. And then like Henrietta Seiberling, getting Dr. Bob to admit that he had this drinking problem. See, those were all things that were critical to the forming of AA, to these people getting sober out there. There have been so many other things that have happened. I kept trying to meet Bill Wilson after hearing him talk in 1951. I wasn't able to meet him that time. But in 1956, I went to Founders Day. See, every June in Akron, they have Founders Day, and 10,000 people come in. It's just a marvelous. It's almost like one of the international conventions. They take over the campus of the University of Akron. They use all the dorms and everything, and they turn the athletic stadium over for campers. People that want to camp there, they camp in the stadium there. And it's just a wonderful weekend, usually good weather too. And of course, they call it Founders Day because Dr. Bob was supposedly took his last drink on June 10th, 19th. And so it's always early in June. And so I went there in 56, and I heard Bill speak on a Saturday night, and I stood in the line to talk to him. I told him I lived in Jackson, Michigan. And he says, well, my knowledge of Jackson goes back to Al Cameron's time. Well, Al Cameron was the guy who had started AA in Jackson in 1939. And Bill had quite a memory for the people that had been involved. A lot of the other stuff that he remembered, he got dates wrong sometimes, but he was sharp on many things. But he told me I told him I'd like to talk to him, and he said he was too tired to send him a letter. And I did when I got back to Jackson, and I got a 3-page letter from him. It just stunned me, and part of the letter is in one of my books now. And in the letter, he told me that for the last 12 years of life, he had suffered from depression about 2/3 of the time. Well, you know, that pissed me off. He had no right to suffer from depression. He was the guy who had written the 12 steps. And for a while, it kind of disillusioned me. But as I got to thinking about it, I realized that was part of Bill's humility, that he never put himself up higher than anybody else. He never said that he had all of these problems mastered or anything like that. In fact, he always said that other people were doing better with the program than he did. And this was just one of these terrible things that he put up with, but he stayed sober all that time. And he continued to do things for AA. He wrote the 12 and 12 when he was suffering from depression part of the time. I go to a noon meeting in Toledo where we go through the 12 and 12 all the time. I've been through the 12 and 12 15 times, I'll bet. And it's not a buoyant book, you know. It's not something that's going to really lift you up because he's talking about some of these problems in working the steps. But that's the reality of being sober and living in AA and day by day and with all of these earth people that we have to deal with. It's really healthy in the long run. I feel that. But that was Bill. There have been some books written about Bill now. One more thing. In 58, I went to Founders Day again. And I got there. I went there with a friend. And this was before I was married, before Lori had the good fortune to meet me. And I was, this friend of mine was pretty much like a sponsor, and we went to Akron, and we stopped. We were going to stay at the Mayflower Hotel, but their rates were $18, and Leo thought that was too much. So we went to a flea bag down the street, a block or two down the street. And so we got up on Sunday morning, and there wasn't a coffee shop in the flea bag, so we walked back up to the Mayflower Hotel. And we went into the coffee shop, and we were sitting at a table. And Bill came in, and he sat down at the counter. And I had known Bill was going to be out there. And so I kind of waved like that. And so as soon as he got his coffee, he picked it up and came over and sat down with us. And he started telling us about some of his hopes for AA and what he was doing these days. He'd kind of overcome that depression that had caused him so much trouble. A lot of his therapy was just walking. He took walks and things like that. Well, then about a half hour or hour later, a man came along to pick Bill up and to take him out to the cemetery. They were going to have a special cemetery or a special ceremony at Dr. Bob's grave, where Dr. Bob and Ann were buried. And that had been in the notice. But I had thought, well, I didn't know Dr. Bob, so probably I shouldn't have attended. So I asked if it was all right if we went. So we followed him out there, maybe a couple dozen cars. We got there, maybe three dozen people. And I suddenly remembered, see, I was a company magazine editor by this time, and I was carrying a camera, and I asked Bill if I could photograph. And he said it was okay. And so we had this little simple ceremony there. Bill just went over to the headstone and started talking to them like they were actually there. And then when he had concluded, we all said the Lord's Prayer. But just as we started, a church bell started ringing just while we were saying the Lord's Prayer. But I'd taken these pictures of Bill, and one of them, even as I took it, I just had the feeling that was going to be a great picture. And now that has been in three or four books, and a couple of my own, by the way, too. And that was just something. Well, then I didn't get back there for 20 years at Founders Day. Got married, and you know what involved there, the family and all of that. And so I never got to attend a Founders Day for 20 years. Next time I came back, my God, they had the same ceremony, and there were thousands of people there. Now they cover the whole cemetery. They say that the motorcycles... There are so many motorcycles that when the first motorcycles arrive at the cemetery, the last ones haven't left the university. So that's what that ceremony has become. But I think that I was involved in the first one when there were only about three dozen people there. And one of the sad things, I heard one woman whisper that Sue Smith, Dr. Bob's daughter, well, her name was Sue Galbraith, I guess, she couldn't be there for that ceremony because her husband was drunk that weekend. It just really made me feel sad. They eventually were divorced, but it was just too bad that she couldn't have been there for that ceremony. Well, anyway, you know, I have talked an hour, and almost an hour, and by God, that's enough to stretch your patience. But I have a special way of closing this kind of a talk, excuse me. Most people don't know it, but I'm a singer. And actually, at age 80, I'm still taking singing lessons. In fact, my singing teacher told me one day that I should be on Oprah. And I said, yes, I'd like to be on Oprah, and I'd also like to be on her show. I shouldn't have. This is all going down on tape, and I'm so ashamed. But I just can't resist this kind of stuff. But anyway, I have a little song that I wrote about the founders of AA. I call it Once There Were Founders. And last time I tried this, my voice was gone, and it didn't go very well. But when I said I was a singer, I didn't mean that I was a great singer. I sang for a couple out in Palm Springs, an older couple that just got married. I sang Some Enchanted Evening for them, and a guy came up and he said, I always wished I could sing. Now I wish you could. But anyway, I wrote these words, and these are a tribute to Bill and Bob. Once there were founders, two men we esteem. They had a vision, a sort of a dream. And though they had struggles, they'd never complain. I wish they were with us again. Once there was darkness, no answer was known. Each of us faced a grim future alone. Then came their vision, and new life appeared. Our founders were with us back then. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, we honor them still, a doctor named Bob and a broker named Bill. Dim was the path when their journey began. I wish they were with us again. And over the long years, their stories were told, and lost souls began to return to the fold. All that they told us turned out to be true. I wish they were with us again. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, both gentle and kind. They gave us this program. It's yours and it's mine. When we came broken, they helped us to mend. I wish they were with us again. So remember the gift from the founders we love, with help from our friends and the power above. Each day we have is a journey begun. I feel they're now with us again. Yes, I feel they're now with us again. Thank you.
Would you be willing to take a few questions?
Oh, did you?